Wow, Jessica. I was just reading through this chapter on hominid coevolution, and it's absolutely mind-blowing. The way it breaks down how we've evolved alongside everything else is just fascinating.
Oh, I know. I was looking at the table of contents earlier. It covers so much, from the very basics of life-generating sets to the nitty-gritty of brain changes. What part really grabbed you?
Well, the whole idea of coevolution itself is pretty wild. The text says something changed with the emergence of hominids and their coevolution with domesticated plants and animals and technology. It's not just us evolving, but everything around us evolving with us and vice versa. It's like a giant ongoing dance.
Totally. And it's not just about the big picture. The chapter dives into the nitty-gritty of how even our bodies and brains have changed. It mentions how when hominids emerged, something changed in that the coevolution of their brains and bodies in context of their environments that allowed, enabled, and or forced them create external artifacts beyond that of previous creatures. And in doing so, we co-evolved with external transportation, manufacturing, and infrastructures as we continue to co-evolve with them. That's a huge statement that we literally co-evolved with the stuff we created.
Exactly. And then it gets into the details of what actually changed, like the section on what changed and is changing in our bodies and brains. It talks about how humans have actually gotten shorter, lighter, and even smaller brained over the last 100,000 years. That's counterintuitive, right? You'd think we'd be getting bigger and smarter in a straightforward way.
Right? And it offers some explanations like average height decreasing and then increasing again with better food and medicine. But the brain size thing is really interesting. It goes from 1500 cc 100,000 years ago down to 1350 cc today. The text admits a comment on what we know and don't know about brains. We don't fully understand why this happened, but it suggests it might be about efficiency rather than just getting dumber.
That's where it gets really deep. The chapter discusses brain changes in detail, mentioning how human brains have seen a dramatic increase in brain size, 3x, particularly the neocortex, now 80% of the human brain, compared to early ancestors. But then it highlights specific areas that have enlarged disproportionately, like the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in higher cognitive functions, like planning future actions, undertaking initiatives, and attention.
And it's not just size, too. It talks about how differences in right and left cerebral hemispheres associated with language areas in humans also occur in chimpanzee brains. But chimpanzees do not have language. But MRI results suggest pathways from temporal to frontal areas in humans involved in language are differently organized in chimpanzees. That's a huge functional difference stemming from structural organization.
Absolutely. And the detail on specific brain regions is incredible. For instance, the posterior parietal cortex being disproportionately large in humans, involved in planning, imitation, and executing reaching, grasping, self-protection, and eye movements. It even mentions how the human brain has more cortical areas, perhaps 150 to 200 more, about twice the number of related species. It's like we've added whole new processing units.
And the comparison with chimpanzees is stark. The text points out large zones of divergence in the middle temporal lobe, temporal parietal cortex, and lateral frontal cortex, with a particular hotspot in the dorsal frontal cortex. It even identifies a hotspot of divergence in medial parietal area 7 and how the right temporal parietal junction, TPJ area in the human brain, shows strong innervation of the ILF. Labeled TPJP and TPJA, the posterior of which shows strong activation in social cognition tasks. This is where things like mentalizing or theory of mind come into play, the ability to understand others' beliefs.
That's the stuff that really makes you think about what makes us human. The chapter also touches on the prefrontal cortex, noting that while there's a continuum rather than a gap in prefrontal functions between non-human primates and humans, in humans, working memory operations are shifted to the posterior portion of the lateral prefrontal cortex, paving the way for the emergence of other, more developed cognitive functions. It also highlights the spectacular development of the frontopolar cortex, BA10, appears to be accompanied by the ability to process information in a more abstract manner.
and it connects these cognitive changes to our history. It mentions how lithic technology, the manufacture of the first tools about 2 to 3 million years ago, indicates that the creation of tools is associated with an understanding of the purpose for their use. Then it goes on to say, the manufacture of the first huts 400,000 years ago testified to the ability to draw up construction plans. It's like a direct link between brain evolution and technological advancement.
The discussion on language is also fascinating. It states the neural language network has a core system representing syntax, lexicon, and sounds, phonology of a language, with related structures that support speech, the speech network. And it's not just about having the capacity, but how different languages shape the brain. It says the neural system is organized around linguistic specifics during native language development, so different patterns, connectivity, and uses are individual to each person based on their experiences.
That's so true. It's not just nature, but nurture and experience shaping our brains. The chapter even says the brain organizes itself around environmental specifics as part of the development process. So different patterns, connectivity, and uses are individual to each person based on their experiences. It really emphasizes how nurture has a great deal to do with cognitive capabilities throughout life.
And the whole concept of changing your mind versus changing your brain is a crucial distinction. It explains that while computers change their minds, state, without changing their brains, hardware, in evolution, the brains of species change in size, structure, makeup, and capabilities, and they do so in coevolution with their bodies and the environments their phenotypes live in.
It's a profound idea. The chapter really lays out how this co-evolutionary process, driven by changes in our bodies and brains, has led to the development of complex societies, technology, and our unique cognitive abilities. It's not just a historical account. It emphasizes that this co-evolution is a process underway today.
So to sum it up, this chapter is a deep dive into how hominids didn't just evolve in isolation, but in a constant dynamic interplay with their environment, their own creations, and each other. The changes in our brains, particularly in areas related to planning, social cognition, and language, are central to this story, and it's a process that's still unfolding.
Exactly. It's a complex web of biological, technological, and social evolution, all intertwined. The chapter provides a comprehensive look at the factors that have shaped us from the fundamental processes of life to the intricate workings of the human brain, and it leaves you with a sense of awe at how far we've come and how much more there is to understand.
So the whole idea is that it's not just technology developing on its own, but it's been co-evolving with us, with our brains. The chapter talks about a limited historical timeline of recent coevolution and how we can see changes we have a sense of and their timing and possible linkage to brain changes. It uses this ya notation, meaning years ago, and explains that it's approximate based on the common era being around 2,000 years ago.
That makes sense. It's like a feedback loop, right? We develop something and that influences how we think or what we can do, which then leads to more development.
Exactly. And it also points out something I hadn't really considered, the concept of generations. It says that if a new population of human children, i.e. a generation, happens every 20 years, that's only 5 generations starting per century, 50 per millennium, and 150 generations since 3000 ya. So when we talk about ancient history, it's not that many people's worth of direct knowledge transfer. It's more like stories passed down, which is a pretty limited chain of narrative transition.
Wow, 150 generations since 3,000 years ago? That really puts things into perspective. It's not like a continuous stream of direct experience for that whole time.
The chapter starts way back, even before Homo sapiens, looking at what prior species were capable of. It mentions things like stone tools, possible use of fire for cooking, bone tools before 1 million years ago. Then it gets into some really early hominid stuff. For instance, the early hominids, Homo erectus, were hunter-gatherers in small groups around 1.2 million years ago.
So even before us, there were signs of tool use and social organization.
Yeah, and it gets even more mind-blowing. It talks about evidence of components of wooden structure using fitted wooden logs found in Zambia that are 475,000 years old. That's 300,000 years before the emergence of Homo sapiens. And then the manufacturer of the first huts 400,000 years ago testified to the ability to draw up construction plans that don't exist in the present.
Building structures and huts? That implies a level of planning and foresight that's pretty advanced.
Totally. And Nonalian Neanderthals weren't slouches either. They mastered fire about 400,000 years ago. Plus, there's evidence of the first symbolic representations of the world, such as the chimerical drawings and the first sculptures, which demonstrated a higher level of abstraction. This was happening between 200,000 and 400,000 years ago.
Chimerical drawings and sculptures? That's art, basically, and abstraction. That's a huge cognitive leap.
Right? And around the same time, the first physiologically similar human sapiens emerged, between 200,000 and 300,000 years ago.
So our species starts showing up, and these other cognitive abilities are already developing in other hominids.
Exactly. Then it moves into what it calls the pre-agrarian society, the first cognitive expansion. It notes that hominid lifespans averaged about 25 years, largely due to infant mortality. But if you made it to 15, you'd live to about 55.
That's a pretty stark difference in life expectancy.
And this is where it gets really interesting regarding brain changes. Starting around 60,000 years ago, humans apparently showed brain structure changes producing increased working memory, components of planning, problem solving, and language production. It also mentions interrelated cognitive changes of greater integration of past experiences and prospective futures, greater capacity to link discontinuous or distant data, temporal or semantic, a greater capacity for abstraction with analogical reasoning and abstract values giving rise to beliefs and morals.
That sounds like the foundation for everything we consider human: complex thought, morality, language.
The chapter even maps these abilities to specific brain changes. For example, increased working memory is linked to the posterior portion of the lateral prefrontal cortex. Language production is tied to left frontal lobe Broca's area. And things like mentalizing or theory of mind and social cognition are associated with areas like the posterior superior temporal cortex and inferior parietal lobule.
So it's not just abstract ideas. There are actual physical changes in the brain that correspond to these new abilities.
Precisely. It calls this largely the end of the nature part of the evolutionary story of human brains at the gross level. Moving on, the timeline gets more specific. Around 1 to 200,000 years ago, it talks about the emergence of verbal and advanced visual signaling communication using words or other similar sounds or sequences of motions indicative of syntax and semantics. This is seen as the start of communicated memes and non-physically enforced control systems.
Communicated memes? That's a modern term applied to ancient concepts. It's like the beginning of culture and shared ideas.
Exactly. The chapter also explains how this allows for indirect control through language, influencing other humans. It suggests that memes may have started as commands or collaborative coordination and eventually transformed into more complex narratives to influence other humans into more complex actions. And it links this to the development of Broca's area for language.
So language wasn't just for describing things, but for coordinating and influencing behavior on a larger scale.
Then, between 72 and 100,000 years ago, it suggests that communication of memes and more complex narratives emerged. This is seen as crucial for coordination of long-distance group travel and group hunting. The chapter acknowledges that verbal communication is not recorded in the archaeologic record, but infers it from the fact that humans migrated in groups, not just as individuals.
That makes sense. You can't organize a big group migration or hunt without some form of complex communication.
It also points out that human child development requires parenting over a period of a dozen years or more, so such groups would have to stay together over time for descendants to survive. And then a really interesting point. Recent studies show that survival of children with storytelling is twice as likely as without. So evolution likely favored the survival of children whose parents told them stories, and groups with narratives likely come to dominate groups without or with fewer narratives.
So storytelling wasn't just entertainment, it was a survival advantage.
Absolutely. and it mentions that sound also travels beyond line of sight and in the dark, and so is more effective for survival in these environments.
That's a practical reason for spoken language to be so important.
Then a major event. 72,000 years ago, African humans left Africa in a single migratory period north, from which all strains of humans outside of Africa were produced. And this happened in groups, and as such, likely involved more complex narrative structures.
So the migration itself was a driver for developing more complex communication.
Then we see early art appearing. 67,800 years ago, rock art was found in Sulawesi, and around 50 to 60,000 years ago, Aboriginal Australians arrived, and no outside interbreeding took place between then and very recently.
That's a long period of isolation for them.
And it notes that smaller brain strains like Homo florentiens died out around 50,000 years ago. Also, around 50,000 years ago, humans leaving Africa interbred with Neanderthals, and that's why about 1 to 4% of the genome of people outside Africa are inherited from them.
So there was intermingling with other hominid species.
Then the chapter introduces the STEM notation for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It says 40 to 50,000 years ago, this is where the first evidence of the emergence of mathematics, science, and engineering occurred. It explains that the origins of mathematical thought lie in the concepts of number, patterns in nature, magnitude, and form, and that these concepts are not unique to humans and were part of everyday life in hunter-gatherer societies.
So even basic math concepts were developing in these early societies.
It mentions that some languages still distinguish between one, two, and many, suggesting a gradual evolution of number concepts. Then, more specific STEM events. 40,000 years ago, the use of yarn, possibly for some sort of record-keeping by Neanderthals, suggests they knew basic concepts in arithmetic. And, interestingly, 40,000 years ago, Neanderthals had current human brain size and went extinct.
So they had the brain capacity, but still disappeared?
Then, 30 to 40,000 years ago, cave paintings and limited musical instruments appeared. And 20 to 40,000 years ago, humans and dogs collaborated and dogs were first domesticated.
Domestication of dogs. That's a huge step in human-animal interaction.
And it notes that people control dogs and dogs people by watching, listening, acting, and talking. Then, a significant point about our physical evolution. 35,000 years ago, the last identified major changes in human brains as reflected only by fossils that show the same globular shape as present-day humans.
So our brain shape stabilized around then.
The timeline continues with migrations to the Americas, the development of groundstone tools around 20,000 years ago, and the Ishango bone, which is interpreted by some as the earliest known demonstration of a six-month lunar calendar, though this is noted to be disputed.
So, early attempts at calendars and record-keeping.
And then it discusses the Upper Paleolithic period, 40 to 12,000 years ago, with more diversity of human artifacts, larger settlements, geographical expansion, disappearance of closely related hominids, early proto-writing and symbols. It also mentions a glacial period that ended as this period ended.
So a period of significant expansion and diversification, coinciding with climate change.
The chapter then poses a question. Are there differences in the split descendants? It talks about four distinct branches of humans that became isolated over time, which is important for understanding co-evolution. These include the original African lineage, Aboriginal Australians, the lineage that interbred with Neanderthals, and the American Indians.
That's a really interesting point, how isolation might lead to different evolutionary paths, even within the human species.
It highlights that the dates of these splits differ from source to source and continue to be updated. It emphasizes that the critical issue is the date of separation, not the date of first appearance. The chapter then dives into some specific studies, particularly focusing on Aboriginal Australians and potential brain differences compared to Caucasians. It's important to note that these studies are based on a limited number of subjects and are presented as autopsy-based.
Okay, so it's not definitive, but it's exploring potential correlations.
Right. One study found brain volume was significantly smaller for Aborigines compared to Caucasians. This included smaller volumes for the cerebellum, cerebral cortex, frontal cortex, and hippocampus. However, the pons media oblongata unit and visual cortex did not differ significantly.
So some areas were smaller, but not all.
The chapter suggests that these differences could be explained by the higher incidence of malnutrition and infectious diseases for Aboriginals during the development of the brain in early childhood, but also states that genetic influences cannot be excluded. It also speculates that the results for the visual cortex might represent an adaptation to living conditions in the bush and desert regions of Australia.
That's a complex interplay of factors, environment, health, and potentially genetics.
It also mentions that Aboriginals had proportionally smaller frontal cortex, parieto-occipito-temporal cortex, and medial visual cortex. These areas are associated with higher cognitive functions like planning future actions, undertaking initiatives, and attention.
So areas linked to planning and higher level cognition were smaller in this study.
On the flip side, Aboriginals had higher visual acuity, visual memory, and rely more on visual strategies for problem solving. The chapter notes that these differences could be explained by the higher incidence of malnutrition and infectious diseases, and also genetic influences. It also points out that there's a global correlation between body size and brain size for humans, and average body sizes in Australia for these populations are significantly larger for Caucasians.
So it's not a simple case of one group being smarter or less evolved. It's about different adaptations and potentially different strengths.
Exactly. The chapter then describes Aboriginal life before European contact as complex hunter-gatherers with diverse economies and societies with developed technologies like spear throwers, boomerangs, shields, grinding stones, fishing nets, and even fire stick farming. They also had complex laws and cultural norms and developed talking sticks for communication.
That paints a picture of a sophisticated society, even without large-scale agriculture or industrial technology.
And it mentions their relationship with dingoes, noting that indigenous Australians tamed kangaroos, wallaroos, emus, cassowary chicks, and lizards. It also states, "No evidence I have found identifies complex tools or machines, significant agriculture, use of electricity, manufacturing, non-walking transportation, or shared infrastructure."
So their technological development took a different path, focusing on tools and strategies suited to their environment and lifestyle.
The chapter continues by saying there may be a link between the development of more complex machines and the differences between Aboriginals associated with their notionally enhanced visual comprehension and recognition and their notionally reduced ability to integrate multisensory information into higher level functions. But the evidence for this is not conclusive. It reiterates that none of these differences with other global human development has any apparent causal link to brain structural changes, but some evolutionary differences correlate well to the lifestyle and environmental conditions.
So it's a correlation, not necessarily causation, and more research is needed.
And finally, it touches on IQ differences, but dismisses them as not relevant to the core issue of brain evolution versus cognitive capabilities, stating that IQ results are often related to culture, education, and other factors than physiology, or in particular, brain function.
That's a good point to make. It's easy to get sidetracked by IQ scores when the real focus is on how our brains have evolved and adapted alongside our technology and societies.
Yeah, it's a really complex and fascinating topic. The idea that our brains and technology have been evolving together for so long, with each influencing the other, is pretty mind-blowing.
Definitely. It makes you wonder what the next steps in that co-evolution will be.
Wow, Jessica. I was just reading this stuff about how civilizations scaled up, and it's seriously mind-blowing. Like, how did they even manage it all?
I know, right? It's like a whole different world. The text talks about how empires like those in Eurasia, India, Africa, China, and South America all developed, but in totally different ways.
Yeah, and the lifespans are wild. It says classical Greece had a lifespan of about 27 years, and if you made it to 15, you might live to 55. Ancient Rome was even shorter, 25 years, but those who hit 15 could expect to live to about 60.
And get this, In South America, before the Aztecs, life expectancy was around 30, but for the Aztecs themselves, it jumped to about 42.1. It's fascinating that it says life expectancy increased over time, along with advances in societies and in science, technology, engineering, and math. It's like a positive feedback loop, a virtuous cycle.
Totally. The longer people lived, the more time they had to figure stuff out and teach it, which then helped people live even longer. That makes so much sense. And it wasn't just about living longer, was it? The text mentions a huge cognitive expansion happening.
Exactly. It talks about the rapid and widespread formation of religion, formalization of documentary forms, and as part of the cognitive expansion of the time, represented elements of narrative and cognitive capabilities extending into the domain of moving from communications-based systems to socially controlled systems. So they started using thinking and communication as a way to manage bigger groups of people.
That's a huge shift. So they were using cognition and communication to control things like transportation, manufacturing, and infrastructure. And those things helped spread ideas and stories even faster, creating another positive feedback loop, a co-evolution.
Precisely. And the text really emphasizes how crucial math was for all of this. It says, mathematics is necessary for the success of a scaled social system because without it, disputes will arise in trading and economic activity that cannot be settled in a systematic or demonstrably fair manner, and engineering-compatible systems and goods across vast populations and areas of land is infeasible.
Yeah, imagine trying to trade without being able to weigh or measure things consistently. The text points out that without that, you get corruption, disputes, and a breakdown of trust, which can destroy a society from within by undermining trust and the social contract of participation. That's pretty heavy.
And then there's the whole climate thing. It mentions how volcanoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, droughts, and similar things have also dramatically altered the course of civilizations by disrupting progress, and when conditions persist for long enough, destroying the civil memory and narrative. Nature really threw some curveballs.
Don't forget war. The text says, and did I mention war? It goes on to talk about continental empires developing between 2,500 and 1,500 years ago, with huge armies and bureaucracies ruling millions of square miles.
And global trade was a big part of that, needing transportation systems that reached across continents. The Silk Road, the Indian Ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, those were massive trade routes, and it all grew and fell through wars, with the success of armies being key.
It's wild how religion and philosophy also popped up independently around the world between 3,500 and 2,200 years ago. You've got Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, Jewish monotheism, Jainism, Greek philosophy with Plato and Aristotle, Confucianism, and Buddhism all emerging around that time.
And the Olympics started around 2,800 years ago. It's like a burst of new ideas and ways of thinking.
Let's dive into Greece a bit more. The text says it's like the mold for many current governmental structures, and in math, it's where the study of mathematics as a demonstrative discipline began with the Pythagoreans, who even coined the term mathematics.
They refined math with deductive reasoning and rigor, and it's cool that the Romans used applied math for surveying and engineering, while the Chinese had a place value system and used negative numbers early on. Prime numbers were a thing back then, too.
Thales of Miletus is called the first true mathematician for using geometry to solve practical problems and for introducing deductive reasoning. Then Pythagoras, after learning from Egyptians and Babylonians, established his school with the doctrine that mathematics rules the universe and motto, all is number.
And the first democratic government emerged in Athens around 2,500 years ago. Then you have the Platonic Academy becoming a mathematical center, with Eudoxus developing the method of exhaustion, a precursor to calculus. Aristotle laid the foundations of logic.
And Euclid's Elements. The text calls it considered by some the most influential textbook ever. It introduced the axiomatic method, definition, axiom, theorem, proof, which we still use. It covered number theory, algebra, and solid geometry, proving things like the irrationality of the square root of 2 and the infinitude of prime numbers.
Archimedes was a genius. He used the method of exhaustion to calculate pi with incredible accuracy and developed formulas for volumes of surfaces of revolution. He even considered finding the surface area and volume of a sphere his greatest achievement.
And Apollonius of Perga, who coined the terms parabola, ellipse, and hyperbola. His work on conic sections is still invaluable for studying planetary motion. Eratosthenes devised the sieve for finding prime numbers, and Hipparchus founded trigonometry. It's like a golden age of math and science in Greece.
Moving to Southeast Asia, the Indus Valley civilization thrived, but then drought scattered them. Later, urbanization returned, leading to the rise of Jainism and Buddhism. The Tao Te Ching was written, Theravada Buddhism spread, and the Hebrew Bible was canonized.
India had its golden age with the Gupta Empire, with major advances in science and math, but invasions eventually destroyed it. And the timeline for India is pretty long, with invasions and changes leading all the way up to the East India Company taking over.
Eurasia, outside the steppe, saw the Roman Empire rise and fall. Its success was due to its roads, standardized animal domestication for transport, communication systems, currency control, infrastructure like buildings and water systems, and its governance. Its longevity led to major cultural developments worldwide.
China's history is tracked by dynasties, from the Shang dynasty with written records and potter's wheel to the Zhou dynasty where Confucianism and Taoism arose. Then the Qin dynasty unified China, built the Great Wall, and created a centralized bureaucracy.
The Han dynasty brought stability, expanded the empire, adopted Confucianism, and supported scientific developments like paper, the rudder, and the compass. They created the Silk Road, leading to economic expansion. Their power was comparable to the Roman Empire.
The Wei dynasty and Three Kingdoms period was a dangerous time with plagues and famines, but technology still advanced with inventions like the wooden ox and the south-pointing chariot. Then the Jin dynasty reunited China, but chaos followed with civil wars.
The northern and southern dynasties saw different families ruling, but arts, culture, and technology advanced, along with Taoism and Buddhism. The Sui and Tang dynasties reunited China, leading to economic prosperity, military security, and cultural sophistication. China became the largest and most powerful empire, with advancements in ceramic production and the invention of woodblock printing.
The Five Dynasties period was chaotic, but the Song dynasty brought prosperity, scientific inventions like gunpowder rockets, and flourishing arts and literature. They also started using paper currency and matches.
Then Genghis Khan invaded, leading to the Yuan dynasty, which increased trade, science, and cultural exchange. The Ming dynasty reinstated Chinese rule, and European traders brought new ceramic designs. The Qing dynasty, China's last imperial dynasty, saw a vastly expanded population, trade, and advancements in colorful enamel porcelain.
Africa is so much more than just the origin of species. Egypt's accomplishments are African, and the continent has a rich and diverse history of civilizations and inventions. It had kingdoms, over 1,200 languages, and many religions.
And the text highlights how water was fundamental to life and civilization there. With growth along coasts, the Nile, and inland lakes, they were cultivating grains and domesticating animals as far back as 12,000 years ago. Pottery was present 11,400 years ago.
The Tishit culture, around 6,000 years ago, had a complex, organized society with a four-tiered hierarchy. And the independent development of agriculture by the Mande peoples was huge.
Egypt's Old Kingdom and the Kingdom of Kerma in Nubia emerged around 5,500 to 4,668 years ago. They were smelting copper and bronze, and West Africa was also developing metalworking.
Egypt had direct relations with Punt for trade, and later the Middle Kingdom was formed after a period of anarchy. Iron smelting was developed independently in Nigeria around 4,000 years ago.
The Nok culture in Nigeria was significant, and West Africa had sizable urban populations with iron metallurgy. The Kingdom of Dimt in Ethiopia developed irrigation and iron tools. The Kingdom of Kush ruled Egypt and continued as a trading state.
Carthage was a major power, engaging in naval warfare with Rome. Dene Dene culture in Mali was important, and cities on the Red Sea transported cargo to India. Eventually, Rome took over Egypt.
The Kingdom of Aksum in Ethiopia became a major trading empire, minting its own currency and carving enormous stelae. Trans-Saharan trade routes were vital for exchanging goods like salt and gold.
South America's description is provided up to the Spanish invasion. The text then shifts to the emergence of mathematics, science, engineering, and medicine, noting that things really started to accelerate about 2,500 years ago.
It emphasizes that advancements in math led to advancements in physics, chemistry, metallurgy, and so on. These developments were necessary for the success of those societies and seemed to arise from an inevitable situation driving focus of attention of societies toward individuals with abilities and interests to develop such systems.
The societies that survived were the ones that developed STEM fields because of their direct impact on warfare, food production, and improving life. Increased interaction with other societies also pushed progress.
The text then breaks down the STEM fields. Physics helped understand force and motion. Chemistry, though still partly alchemy, developed methods for creating materials. Metallurgy allowed for stronger and more durable materials.
Geoscience focused on finding and using natural materials. Computation, initially human-powered, became machine-operable for efficiency. Biology led to understanding selective breeding and disease spread.
Medicine moved from religion to scientific exploration, helping people survive injuries and mitigate disease. Linguistics was vital for sharing STEM advancements across different languages.
Economics grew from the necessity of trade and taxation, with math as a basic enabler. Psychology and sociology were core to understanding how memes and narratives worked in social control.
Philosophy was about rationalizing why things are the way they are, closely tied to religion and narratives that held societies together or tore them apart. Education is highlighted as core to building societies through STEM and a good predictor of a society's future.
The section on memes and narratives in the second cognitive expansion is fascinating. It talks about how information sharing is required for trades to flourish and how ideas spread like a disease through social networks.
And the text points out that rumors could spread very rapidly, and if there's economic strife, it can have larger market impacts by changing confidence levels. Controlling these narratives was crucial for political systems to prevent collapse.
Strategies for narrative control included religion, which creates a hierarchy of trust and uses memes and expressions to manage behavior. Social structures like legal systems and policing also acted as control mechanisms.
The power bases of orators, military forces, and means of production could be used for cognitive control. Coalitions between religious and political leaders were common, and social groups created alternative trust models, sometimes prioritizing loyalty to the group over family.
The final section, Then What, talks about how the level of detail decreases as populations grow and gross trends take over. It mentions the limitations of reading and writing skills, transportation speeds, and the use of simple machines.
It highlights the systematic approaches to growing, making, transporting, and supporting systems as infrastructure, along with monetary instruments and the ability to do calculations for design and procurement.
The text notes that transportation, manufacturing, and infrastructure thrived and innovated along with civilization, but then asks why, implying that something significant happened to change the trajectory, even with events like wars, ecological changes, and the Mongol expansion. It leaves you hanging, doesn't it?